The next case is 99-1987, Centurion Fuel Corporation versus Grafner W. Tracy, Tax Commissioner. Justice Cook has recused herself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Cook. Judge Timothy McMonigle, who's a judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 8th District. Welcome, Judge McMonigle.
Thank you.
Mr. Sauer.
Thank you. Please record. This case has the ultimate issue. Evaluation of nuclear fuel is the subject of a lease by two companies, Centurion Fuel Company and OES Fuel. Operators of electric utilities who are operators of Davis Bessie Fuel Plant and Perry Nuclear Power Plant. The issue is controlled by two statutes which present two questions for this court, two areas where we submit more tax of care decisions. First section is section 571121, which requires that when property is leased to a public utility, it is to be valued in the same manner as the property would be if owned by that utility. The second section is 572711, which sets forth prescribed certain cost-based calculations of value depending on the type of property and type of utility. As part of that provision, subsection F, which used to be subsection G, provides that you shall not include AFUDC or interest during construction in such calculations. In the present case, the appellant for the fuel companies claim deductions for capitalized interest, which they incurred after they received orders from electric companies to buy and have fuel process for use at these two plants. They recovered those interest costs along with their other direct costs of processing through lease payments that provide under leases that were called net leases. The net leases provided that they were entitled to recover every dollar they spent, and in addition to recover interest on the amount of expenditures, capitalized expenditures, that had not been recovered at the point of each rental payment calculation. Now, the tax commissioner went in and audited these companies. And as you'll see from their tax commissioner's final order in both cases, as well as the field audit report, the tax commissioner took the entire booked cost, the unamortized cost, the cost is amortized as reimbursed under the lease. The tax commissioner took this unamortized cost as the present value of the future stream of income, the entire income under the lease. That is the reimbursement of capitalized costs plus the interest earned on that cost. The tax commissioner said this is the present value of that income stream under the lease. This court, Texas Eastern, has told us, and we know from that decision, that in applying invaluable property, you must look at the best competent evidence of that value. The CC Leasing Company, which was an earlier case that also involved a lease of fuel rods, this court said, found that this unamortized cost of the fuel rod under a very similar lease was the best evidence of the fuel's value in that case.
Wasn't the statute changed after CC leasing?
Right. That's when it said.
Isn't that the answer?
In the same manner. But subsequent to the change in the statute, we know that Texas Eastern decided the statute prescribes the manner in which fuel rods would be valued if owned by the electric companies is itself merely a prima facie estimate of value. And that estimate of value must itself yield to competent evidence. In Texas Eastern, we had a situation in which the taxpayers, in that case a pipeline company, went in and they got an income-based approach of appraisal to that property. What was the anticipated income stream from owning that property and capitalized with that? Much in the same way that the unamortized, capitalized, or booked cost of this leased fuel is the present value of the result of capitalizing back at the current interest rate. We have in the leases an income approach because we have the present value of that future stream of income.
Council, the tax commissioner chose to ignore the plain language of the statutes that you articulated. And the value of this property under his, he has authority when the statutes do not provide a correct or reasonable value to find an alternative way to the value. Is that the mechanism that he used to get to his method of valuation?
Yes, but right. That, ultimately, that's exactly what happened. But except that I would disagree with the statement that he ignored the statute.
Well,
he did not ignore the statute.
But he opted under his authority.
Have to use it.
And actually under his mandate, under his
to go to an alternative method of valuation. Did he get an appraisal or any expert opinion as to that?
No, he wasn't required to. The statute doesn't say that you can only use competent evidence if you have retained an appraiser or an expert to endorse that evidence. The statute says that if you're presented with competent evidence, the Texas Eastern decision says if you're presented with competent evidence, you have to consider it.
So the competent evidence is simply to add back the capitalized, or add in the capitalized interest and carry charges to determine the value.
Well, the competent evidence is the lease itself. And the provisions of the lease, which state that for every dollar you invest, be it in a direct cost or an indirect cost, or capitalized interest, you are not only getting back that dollar, but you're getting back a return on that dollar. And all of those costs, both direct and indirect costs...
Council, I guess the thing that I'm trying to unwind here in my mind is we have... This is a tax case. But overlaying that is the fact that these are utility companies who have the right to pass on to their own consumers all of these costs. Now they get to pass on everything. The embedded interest, the whole ball of wax. Does that really help you determine what's the appropriate valuation of personal property? The fact that when they're charging their own consumers, they get to roll all of this in and make the consumers pay for it.
No, I don't think so. That's not the basis of our position, and that is something that I can see the General Assembly addressing that or considering that factor in determining how it's going to structure. But we're not relying, and I'm not relying on it here.
Are these fuel rods, is there a market in this, or are they tailor-made for these particular facilities built to order?
Years ago,
and shop around for
it. Well, actually, the court touched on that, I think, in CC leasing, where it talked about the fact that once you load them into the court, although you may, I think there was testimony that you may pull them out and reintroduce them, something like that.
But I mean,
there's no second market.
Right. These corporations were preparing actually manufacturing.
Well, they were contracted to have different stages in Richmond Assembly perform pursuant to directives that comes from
the corporations that leasing the to the utility. The corporation that was leasing the rods, the corporation that actually owned the rods, subcontracted out the...
Actually, the utility identified the various enrichers in the process. They go to the leasing company, much as we might go to a leasing company when we want.
Well, this is all...
We've identified who our suppliers.
In a way, this is all corporate subterfuge anyway, because these are wholly owned. They're interconnected all the way up, right?
Actually, OES Fuel is a subsidiary of Ohio Edison. Centurion Fuel is a subsidiary of Huntington National Bank.
Oh, that's a trust. That's a blind trust for the corporation.
But,
I mean, I don't know if that has anything to do with value, this, but to... If the utility didn't go through this corporate subterfuge that I choose to call it, and just did this on their own, how would they have to be done?
Besides, that's not subterfuge. They form a corporation
to borrow
money.
Under the statute, they would take the capitalized cost, they would go to the FERC formula in Chapter 1, Part 101, Section 3A17. They would do a calculation based on the rate, based on their debt structure. They would calculate the maximum amount of the interest that they could characterize as AFUDC, and then they would deduct that from that cost basis, and then under Section 572711B, apply the annual. Actually, they wouldn't, because fuel stock doesn't even apply annual depreciation allowances. They would take that net cost, use it as their value. Except that under Texas Eastern, they could bypass it all if they went out and got an appraisal to produce a lower figure. That's what happened in Texas Eastern. If you look back in Texas Eastern, there was no AFUDC deduction, because AFUDC, or interest earned deduction, which is a deduction for pipeline companies, is a cost basis. The deduction is only taken when you're doing a cost-based approach to value. But if you're doing the present value of the income stream, you don't have that cost basis. AFUDC, or interest earned deduction, simply don't come into play. So in answer to your question, an electric company would have gone through the calculation, would have done an AFUDC computation, deducted that from its capitalized cost. That would have been the prima facie estimate of the value of the fuel rod. However, if they then went out, an electric utility then went out and had decided they wanted to challenge valuation under 572711D, they could go out and get an appraisal, as Columbia or Texas Eastern did.
But either way, the embedded interest costs would not be included in the value.
No, not either way. Only if they did the statutory cost-based calculation. If they went out and got an appraisal,
then it might be.
Then you could be capitalizing the whole income flow, and you come up with the value, you allocate that value out among your various assets in the system. And that's what you basically have here with the lease and the present value of the lease payment.
So coming back then to what Justice Douglas asked, the statute changed. And that doesn't, in your view, change the outcome.
What it does is it sets up that first step. It requires the tax commissioner to go to that first step and do look at the calculation. But if there's an income, and it's not going to, we recognize that under leases, you may have leases that in which the projected stream of income is not that certain. But here, when you've got a very defined stream of income, and you can trace it back. This is based on a representation from one of the taxpayers' representatives to the agent, that it was the present value of those future lease payments. That's what the tax commissioner worked with on it. And consistent with what this court has said in Texas Eastern, and actually Texas Eastern says it's a mandate for the tax commissioner, that statutory basis, which we do will look to, but it must yield to this other competent evidence.
But is it that clear, Mr. Sauer? I admit to you that I was stay confused about this case because it has not been an easy case for me, given all these interlocking corporate entities and the lease back and the change in the statute and the capitalization, especially when I used to deal in it. We used to just call it construction interest. Now it's called allowance for funds used during construction. So I admit that to you starting. But when I look at your argument, and tell me why this isn't right, when I look at your argument, it seems to me that if they can't deduct it, then the lessor would have a right to deduct it, and the amount comes out the same. Let's assume that the using entities cannot remove this construction cost. Let's assume that you're right in your argument with regard to that. Somebody's got to be able to use Section G of the statute, don't they? And can't it be the lessor?
The
manufacturer lessor?
Starts with Section G, just as the lessee would, the lessee owns.
Okay, I understand.
Stop with that. And just as in a case where the lessee, well, where the electric company or the utility obtained an alternate valuation, if an alternate valuation and competent evidence of an alternate value is presented and considered, subsection G doesn't even come into play.
So you're saying in this case, no entity gets to capitalize the interest?
The deduction of capitalized interest was solely for the purposes of achieving a true value.
Yes.
We pointed out in our initial brief, that deduction was enacted in 1988 following a practice that had been followed in the department based on the theory that AFUDC somehow inflated value as a cost indicator of value. However, if you're not using a cost-based calculation, you don't have that inflation in there. If you're capitalizing the income stream and determining value in that way, the present value of the income stream, there's no risk that you're going to have an inflation of value by including it because you are not assembling a value by adding a cost. Costs are important here only insofar as taxpayers and represented in the department found that they are the present value, the net book value, the present value of that income stream. That's all of it.
How would you have it work then? That these rods are manufactured, and of course somebody's got to borrow money because they're expensive. If you've ever toured that Davis-Bessie plant like I have, they show you those fuel rods and all of those things that go into it. I mean, they're really expensive to manufacture. You can't take that out of cash flow. Somebody's got to borrow money from, as they did here, banks and I think brokerage houses or something. All right, so that to manufacture it, they've got to borrow money. So they manufacture it. That money costs them something. Why isn't that part of their overall cost?
It is part of their overall cost.
All right, then why can't they capitalize it? Okay, then why can't they take deduction for it?
Because they do take a deduction when they're doing a cost approach, a cost-based calculation of values. We never said they can't take a deduction if they can quantify what would be AFUDC. That's the other part that we argued in our brief. They can take a deduction, but it's only quantification evidence of value.
Okay, now after our CC case, tell me why the General Assembly changed the statute, specifically what we were discussing in CC, to a new G, the cost of property subject to a sale and lease back, and you know what it says. Why did they make that change in the statute?
Sale and lease back.
Why did they... No, no, I know. Why did they amend the statute after our CC case?
I don't know. I do know that during the 80s, there were a series of issues where subsidiaries were being set up by a variety of utility companies, including telecommunications companies, that created a situation in which listing percentages prescribed by statute were avoided, evaluation was changed. The General Assembly, I think it's addressing a number of things, but I can't tell you why they did it, why they changed that statute.
Well, under the old statute, F was very clear, wasn't it? True value of taxable property described in so-and-so shall not include the allowance for funds used during construction or interest during the construction, which has been capitalized in the public utilities books. That was changed. Was it not?
That's the deduction we're talking about.
Yeah.
The subsection was changed.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, G was never in the original statute.
They just simply reordered sections when other sections were added. What we're talking about is that AFUDC deduction and a requirement for capital. Or that you remove that cost-based calculation.
All right, before you sit down, maybe it'll help if you can tell me where current G is in the old statute.
I'm sorry, but I think that's the issue here. The statute during the years in question.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sauer.
Mr.
Young.
Not there.
It isn't. Chief Justice, members of the court, opposing counsel, if I speak a little bit during my argument, whether kind of fertilizes my latent bronchitis.
Was current G in the old statute?
Yes.
Where?
What happened, Your Honor, is let me back up and answer your question from the beginning. The question was, why was the statute amended after CC leasing? And very simply, the answer is this. Prior to CC leasing, what utilities attempted to do was lease certain personal property in order to avoid the disparity in percentage of true value. If you're a general taxpayer, let's say you pay 25% of true value. If you're a public utility, you pay 88 to 100% of true value. So what did they do? They say, the lessor said, I'm not a public utility. I'm a lessor, therefore I pay 25% of true value rather than 88%. The tax commissioner said, no way. The court said, no way. So the court said, we'll look to the use, not to the form over substance. The use of the property is for a public utility. Therefore, we'll look at it that way. Thereafter, the legislature, in effect, confirmed CC leasing, and what was really amended was 5711-21C. 5711-21C was amended to say that when there is a lease of personal property to a public utility, you value that property the same as if it was owned by a public utility. And that answered the problem, and that ended the thought that leases could provide any tax advantage in the public utility field. That is the change that took place after CC leasing.
Does the statute, or some statute, say that public utility property, the purpose of valuation, is valued only on a cost basis?
Yes, Your Honor, that's 5727-11E now.
Is it clear that that laps over to leased property? That you can only, because if I understand Mr. Sauer's argument, he's saying three recognized methods, price, market, cost, and income approach, and here the taxpayer or the tax commissioner determined that the cost approach was not the appropriate way to measure the value for tax purposes of this property and opted to use the income approach, and his further answer to the last expert is that in using the income approach, it was purely mechanical. You just do the numbers.
The fundamental
take the lease and end up with evaluations using the recognized income approach to the appraisal. So it seems to me where the dispute then comes down to is whether or not the tax commissioner has the authority to use the income approach here, or whether or not there are statutes that indicate it can only be a cost approach when evaluating public utility property or lease.
I must concede that Mr. Sauer is correct that the statute calls for a prima facie cost-based approach. You report the cost and then deduct the capitalized interest.
That would be the
prima facie method.
The statutory prima facie method, because in the accepted appraisal world, you wouldn't necessarily deduct the capitalized interest costs in determining the cost. But here the statute says you do.
That's right. Now, in order to avoid that, the two things the commissioner would have to do, he'd have to come in and say, that's wrong in this particular unusual case, that doesn't properly reflect true value, and therefore, I'm going to use an alternate formula that I can convince the Board of Tax Appeals more accurately reflects true value. But here's what he really did, and that's why everybody's confused. It was kind of a, I shouldn't use sleight of hand.
Well,
it's not close to sleight of hand. What he did was this. He turned around and deducted the assessment itself, exactly deducts nothing else, no alternate formula. He simply deducted, made us put back in the interest that we took out pursuant to the statute, exactly to the penny. Now he turned around and has to think, well, how can I?
So what your argument is, he's using the cost analysis, cost basis analysis, and the numbers derived therefrom to get to what Sauer's calling the income approach to determine the value of the lease.
Exactly, that's exactly what he did. And now, because of the income approach, first of all, let's really think about the statute.
And just, well, what rate of return, if you use the income approach, what was his assumption as to rate of return?
There's no income.
Yes.
There's no income.
It's a wash.
It's a wash, and that's the answer to this whole case is the word wash. I had down in my notes, I had a partner, and I always used to start out his brief saying, in a nutshell. Well, in this argument, in a nutshell, the answer to this whole case is a wash. And the reason is this. You capitalize the interest on your books in order, for rate-making purposes, that you can properly spread that cost over the appropriate period of time and the appropriate customers. But this legislature made it perfectly clear, you put it in the books for that cost purpose, for rate return, and then you take that exact amount out for a personal property tax return, and it ends up a wash. And that's why there was a lot of question about, well, how much should you really put in and how much should you take out? The statute says whatever was capitalized on the books as either quality construction interest or allowance for funds used during construction, whatever you put on, for rate-making purposes, you take off for valuation purposes. But there's even a more fundamental problem with the approach that the tax commissioner is taking now. To try to hide the fact that he simply put the interest right back in, he calls it, he used the income approach. Now, number one, there's no income. Number two, let's think about that for a second.
There is no income. There's no payment by the utility to this
itself. That's why it isn't.
What's that?
It would be paying itself. It's a wholly owned capital subsidiary of the utility set up for one purpose and one purpose alone. Because when they tried to finance, as Justice Douglas indicated, these very expensive nuclear fuel rod assemblies, they found out that a separate entity, not called a public utility, could issue commercial paper and develop lines of credit at lower interest rates than the utilities themselves that had had some difficulties. The only reason there's a lease here is to get better financing and to issue better commercial paper.
Well, there is a check. I mean, how do you go to the banker and say, we want to borrow X millions of dollars, but we're going to have no income?
No, that's right. You can't do that. It's the difference between income and revenue. Basically, then the lease is set up because it's me leasing my right hand leases to my left hand. So I have my left hand pay my right hand exactly the amount back. But there's no need to put income or profit in there because it's the same person. So there is no income stream. There's simply a return of cost, number one. But more importantly, Justice Breyer,
then there is a, on the books, there is a financial transaction that reflects an annual compensation, whether it's revenue or income or whatever it is, there's a number, a dollar number associated with the lease of these rods every year.
That's Exactly correct. When you set up your captive, it issues the commercial paper. The cost that it incurs comes back from the rate once the rates are paid.
But what you're saying is if the tax commissioner was using the income approach, the tax commissioner did not take that dollar figure and then say, well, a fair rate of return is X, so using the income approach, this dollar figure that is a wash in terms of these corporations, you would end up at X value.
I think you'd end up with a wash, but I think the important thing is going back to CC leasing. There's a big difference. If you read the CC leasing case, it was not a captive subsidiary lessor. It was a commercial lessor and built profit into, as a commercial lessor would, built profit into its calculations of the lease. So it got all its costs back, plus it got a profit for doing this, and there's no need when the right hand is to the left.
I'm not concerned with profit. I'm concerned with what is the actual evidence that the tax commissioner used to arrive at the alternative value. What did they put into evidence?
No, they
just a gross number?
They didn't arrive at an alternative value. They just put the interest back in, and then later on they called it that they were using an alternate approach.
They were using the income approach.
They used the cost approach, and they took capitalized interest that's supposed to be deducted and simply put the exact amount back in. I think probably, and incidentally, we have had here, and I can look it up now because I haven't taken much time, and we have a chart in evidence, and maybe it's sitting over there, maybe it isn't. We have a chart in the evidence that basically shows that the effect of what he did, and here it is, Exhibit 41. Here's the tax. The law is clear. You must tax it as a public utility. The lease. No question about that. That's what CC leasing led to. In this Exhibit 41, the first plaque shows the tax if it was a public utility. The second, just about double tax, by trying to tax it the way they did, and they simply doubled the tax by refusing to follow the statute. And that's what has taken place here, and there's absolutely no question about that.
And I suppose that's where your equal protection argument comes.
Yes, but I hope we never get to that.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you, this is a statutory case and or your equal protection. MCI doesn't really apply to this case, does it? That's a wholly different situation.
Well, the equal protection argument simply comes from the fact that this, as a result of CC leasing, the General Assembly put them in the same class and said it's the same, and therefore if you don't tax, you've got a problem. I don't think we get to that because it just seems so obvious here what the tax commissioner did is refuse to follow the statute. May I point out one other thing that I think is even more fundamental than the wash that Justice Douglas talked about, and that is how ironic it would be if the General Assembly and the Ohio Supreme Court said, when you have lease arrangements like this, you value it as if there were no lease, and if it's owned by the public utility. Okay, that's what you're supposed to do. Now, how in the world, if we value it that way, do we go back and talk about the lease? The lease is gone. The General Assembly tells us that no, you don't consider the lease, you value it if it's owned by the public utility. Well, if the public utility owns it certainly doesn't have to go out and set up a captive and lease it. So it's a second way why the valuation method used by the tax commissioner is totally inconsistent with the statute.
But even if you do it the second way, it still comes out the same.
Exactly. There's only one thing that perhaps could have happened here, and inconceivably, because there is no secondary market in this case, they could have gone out and gotten an expert, come in and said, there are very unique circumstances here, and the true value is really higher than the prima facie statutory value. Now, theoretically, that could have been done. It wasn't done. There isn't a single shred of evidence to suggest anything other than that the statutory presumption is a prima facie case is correct. There isn't a single shred of evidence to the contrary, and so they simply took the capitalized interest.
Well, I mean, we do know we couldn't buy these things at the price you're taxing, because hey, there's no profit included, and now there's no carry cost for interest, so. It's unlikely that you're going to find anything in the marketplace. price below the price that we're talking about here for tax purposes.
Or price higher. Or price higher because of the fact that the direct costs are considered in the capitalized cost basis that the statute calls for, Your Honor. I think the only argument could be we disagree with the legislature. We don't think you should be able to deduct the capitalized interest, but the statute is clear, and I think that's when the counsel stood up and said, this case is controlled by two statutes, and he's 100% correct. The answer to any question in this case is controlled by looking at 5727E and 5711C. Those two statutes have answer every question in this case.
It doesn't seem to be in this case, but you made some statement early on about the utilities being taxed at 90% or something like that. Wasn't there, with respect to these facilities, some change in the law or something that brought things down to 50%?
It's moved all around. At the time of CC leasing, I believe it was approximately 25% of value for the general taxpayer, and 88-100 for the public utility. At the time of 1993, this chart, Exhibit 41, shows that here's what the general taxpayer would have paid, the personal property tax. Here's what a public utility pays, not quite double. And then here's what they were trying to make the lessor pay, double the public utility and triple the general.
Yeah, but when you show the general, it's not quite that easy. When you show the general taxpayer, they're not entitled to any
creative
accounting that takes out some of the fair market value of personal property.
This is an actual computation made by the experts in the case. They took the general taxpayer, they took the public utility, and they took the lessor. This isn't hypothetical. This is the accountant went right through and showed the difference in tax. And today, the public utilities are in tax much higher.
So I'm supposed to believe the accountant wouldn't engage in any creative
It wouldn't do what?
Engage in any creative account.
No more than I would, Your Honor. I'm sure you accept that. I think in conclusion, I would just point
out. Mr. Young.
There's one word, and that's wash.
Yeah.
You put it in for rate-making purposes, you take it out for personal property.
Just as a matter of curiosity, with all of this leasing back, buying, changing, determining, construction, creative accounting, does any of this end up in the rate base?
Very definitely. The interest and
which is really maybe their concern.
And the path, what if they decided a case to the court at the last minute, and that was the United Telephone Company.
Yes.
You'll remember the language in that case. The commissioner first contends that because the value of the dead and bad parts is included in United Telephone's public utility rate base, it must also be included for personal property tax purposes. We disagree. In his dissent in Hatchadorian, Justice Locher set forth this argument. Nevertheless, the court rejected it. We reject it here. Subjecting property to taxation occurs under tax statutes, not public utility rate statutes. And basically, that's what the legislature decided here, Your Honor. Thank you, dear.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Mr. Sauer, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
United Telephone recited the proposition that burden is on taxpayer payment deductions to do introduce evidence supporting that. In this case, they did not even attempt to do an AFUDC deduction. But in a nutshell, what the issue here is and what the controlling fact is that undisputed present value of the lease payments is an amount that is settled. And we know it's competent evidence of that future stream. And there was absolutely no evidence in the record of either of these cases that these lessor corporations would have sold their interest in the fuel rod for a dollar less than the present value of that future stream of income. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised our opinion on our conclusion to your court.
All rise.